Accession number 29238, reel 14.
Mr. Wiggum, reel 14.
David was and another lad on board. They were victims of one of these marriage mix-ups, you know. And they hadn't any parents on board. They were in the charge of another lady. And so we just got Pally, and he's spent a lot of his time with me. They pulled in at Gibraltar. Didn't get ashore on Gib. We just stopped there to take on mail and one thing another and lay off, anchored off. And then set off round, got to Liverpool, I think it was the 28th of October, certainly it was something like that, October, and landed at the White Star landing stage. Now, when I said in one of the earlier tapes about us fire-watching in Liverpool, at Vulcan Street and Boundary Street, it was the White Star landing stage had been right at the bottom of this area where we were fire-watching. And that was quite an event, because the railway came in, you know, the passenger line has left from there, but it was on a higher level along the back of the landing stage, and relations and folks had come down, and the platform was packed with folks up above us waving their hands up. And actually the ship came in, how the skipper managed to get her in, I don't know, because I've got a photograph of her. She has a distinct list to port. You'd think she'd been pulled, because everybody was at the over at that side at the rail. The old Lord Junior came in listing for all she was worth, and then we got ashore off there, and we were whipped up to a transit camp at Margol at Liverpool. And we had to spend just one night, I think. And there were ladies there to attend to our requirements with meal and cups of tea and sandwiches and supper. And our CO was there, so he saw to it that we got our service badges and things sewn onto our uniforms and made it look the way we should do. And the ladies did that for us. And the next day we entrained for Sunderland from Liverpool, and we came to Newcastle and then through to Sunderland. And Sunderland station was absolutely packed with relations, and there were five of us had our heads out of one of the old carriage windows with me on the bottom. I thought I was going to get my head cut off with the weight, you know. And I couldn't move, but at any rate, we all piled out of the train, and two of my sisters and my uncle were there. Sadly, my father died in 1942, and there was another uncle waiting at the top of the slope up from the station, and the sister of a great pal of mine who was in the regiment, but he'd been moved to Formosa. With a friend, they were at the top, knowing I was coming home. They weren't there looking for me. They knew he wasn't coming home just yet. He came home a few days later. And then my uncle had his little Ford car there, and he drove us all up to Hilton. And word had got round the village as well. And we lived bang in the middle of the village in a big house called Ford Villa, which is now the Jolly Potter's pub. I was born and bred and reared there. And we pulled up outside of Ford Villa, and Mother came to the front door, and all these folks packed on the pavement opposite, you know. And amongst them was a body, Violet Giles. Well, Violet, a younger woman, had been maid with Mother for 14 years, and she'd known me since I was born. She was like one of the family, really, was Violet. She would never, you know, she always used to keep popping in one or the other. And I got out of the car, I saw Mother, and I ran round because I had studs in my army boots. And I slipped on the road, grabbed the car to support myself. And violent, then there was one old body said, "Hey lad, didn't I go and vick your neck afore you see your ma?" And I ran up to the front door inside, and I was home where I'd been born and bred. What a lovely feeling it was, too, you know.
I was just going to ask what sort of what was going through your mind.
Yes, because a number of the family were there. The rest of them all came down in the evening. They'd come round from the various parts of the country where they lived, because my eldest sister was at Birmingham, my brother was in Yorkshire, and my youngest sister was at York, and her husband, and they all got up. The only one who wasn't there was my eldest sister's husband, my brother-in-law, who was still in Gibraltar. He was in the army, and he was in Gibraltar. But all the rest of the family were there, with a niece who had been a baby in arms when I last saw her. And two, in fact. One a little bit beyond being a baby in arms, but another one was actually born at the house when I was on embarkation leave. And then another two who I'd never seen, you know, so the family had grown a little bit. And an aunt of mine, who'd been like a second mother to us all, bless her, she was there, and another sister had come up from, one of them, from Guildford, I think. So we had quite a handful.
What sort of celebrations did you
have? We had a very good do. Well, that night, it was just sort of chatter, you know. The next day we had a large dinner. My brother had got hold of a goose. He was in agriculture. He managed to get hold of his goose. And we had a really big spread the next day. So that it was home, sweet home at last, you know, after 6.5 years and 4.5 of them out of the country. But it was all, let's say four and a half, no, four. It was almost 4 years to the day from leaving that we docked at Southampton. And then I was still, of course, in the army until January. And I went down to Fulford Barracks, York, and got demob and got my demob suit and trilby hat and raincoat and pair of shoes and shirts and things, you know.
What did you do before you were demobbed? Between that period of coming home?
I was on leave.
You were just
on leave? Oh, yes, yes. We were on pretty indefinite leave, really, until we were demobbed. You know? Fully paid, well, unpaid. Of course, another got a few more rations because we got an enhanced ration allowance on account of being prisoners of war. Well, that helped a little bit, you know, that.
And what was it like being back at home, back at Sunderland after the war?
Well, it was very different, really. I mean, as the village was Hilton, you know. Well, I say very different, and the village was the same. But a number of the lads were still away. A number of my friends were never coming back. And you had to get accustomed to all this, because we'd had no news of anything like that for 3.5 years, you see. I had two letters from a very good friend of mine, an old school pal, who was at school together, lived at Clean. He was a sea engineer with the Blue Star Line. The two letters, and they stopped in 1943. I thought, that's strange. I don't think John would have stopped writing. What's happened? And he lived with his mother and granny and grandfather, who was also a retired chief engineer. And one day when I was in town, he came over and saw my sister. and explained to her that John had been on the Melbourne Star when it had, nobody knew what had happened to it. But there were only three survivors who were on a raft for about a month before they were picked up. And so he'd gone, poor lad. So there's things like that, you know, you have to get your head round. One of the really unfortunate things, I mean, there were five of us out of our village joined the regiment as territorials, and one only son, I had known him and the family all my life, who didn't come back. Because Ernie was on, I think, about the last party that the Japs tried to send from Thailand to Japan, and they were torpedoed by an American submarine. Because there were no markings on the ship to indicate the prisoners of war or anything. And we lost about 40 lads out of the regiment, and then how many altogether. There were one or two survivors, but not from our lot. One survivor from our lot, sorry, one. There was a film on the television made about a year or two ago. The submarine is now in a sort of museum, not for that reason, but it's big in America. And it went back to look for survivors. And it picked up a number who'd been afloat for quite a few days, or quite a long time anyway. Now, it was bad enough, or it would have been bad enough, going up and seeing Mr. and Mrs. Bell and offering my condolences, which I wanted to do, apart from the fact that it was my duty to do, in my opinion. But what made it worse was that one fella in the regiment who'd been a friend of Ernie's, or anyway he knew Ernie, well, he was a friend, I don't know, got back ahead of me, and whether he wanted to ingratiate himself with the Browls or what, I don't know, but he told them that Ernie had taken my place on that trip, which was an absolute fabrication, because I'd been sent from Chung Kai down to Nakhompaten, the hospital camp, before the party was formed. There was never any question of me being on it, because they always try to keep the lads together for anything like that. And this party had been selected from another battery in the regiment, you know, we all knew each other, but not from a battery, it wasn't from my battery. And I had mother told me that, and I went up with that knowledge to see the folks. They were very, very nice, Mr. and Mrs. Brown were awfully nice people, and they said, Keith, we took it with a pinch of salt, you know. We never knew whether it was right or not. And in any case, if he had taken your place, there must have been a good reason for it. But, and, you know, we never felt sure about it. Well, as I can assure you, that it wasn't correct. And I wasn't even there at the time. But if that had happened in a town in Sunderland, where you could have been at one side of the town and they living at the other, it would have been bad enough, but not too bad. But in a village where everybody knows each other, you know, it was a nasty thing to come home to. But it didn't spoil the homecoming. But it was another thing you had to get used to. Just as, I mean, they gave a dance in the church hall, a celebratory dance at which we were sort of guests of honour almost, and a very nice evening it was, except that Every time you looked at the corner of the church hall where we all used to congregate, you could see faces that weren't there and weren't going to be. And so, yeah, you know, all these things you just had to come to terms with.
I guess that must have been difficult to come to terms with.
It was. But you did, and I mean, you knew that the lads themselves wouldn't want you to mourn and moan about it. You had to get on with it. But naturally, you saw all the parents and expressed your condolences and one thing or another. It was appreciated, but that's all you could do. And my friend at Clean, I went straight over and saw them, and we went over for years while they were there. The old folks were alive, my wife and I, and the children, you know, when they were little. We used to go over, never lost touch with them. I was photographed in the bedroom upstairs. But there we are, you know, that's war. Horrible thing. What a waste.
You mentioned demob. What was the procedure for your demobilisation? What happened?
Well, virtually, you went down there in your uniform and you got your demob papers and your service books, etc. And you got your new civilian clothing, and you could either change and come back in them or come back in your uniform. If I remember rightly, I guess I stayed in my uniform temporarily because I was going on to my brother who was living at the time at Howden and going to a dance with them all. So I just arrived there in my uniform and then changed when I got there. But there was no great ceremony or anything like that, you know. Far too many for them to handle, you know. It was a case of you can get them through like a sausage machine, really.
Did you get a pension?
Not a pension then as such. Years afterwards, my doctor got at me to apply because of my queer tummy and one thing and another. And then I went up to Edinburgh for an investigation into the problem of strongyloides, which a lot of the lads had got. That was a worm of some sort. I didn't have, fortunately. But there, those doctors all pestered us to, you know, to get in for a pension. And I applied, and I got a one-off, nothing to 5% pension, which was a down payment of like £700 I got, and that was it. I could, you know, if things had deteriorated and could be shown, I mean, if I could prove my legs had been bury, I could probably go back for something, but I could never prove that, of course. But,
was there a question of you being retained, or did you have to go back to the territorials?
I didn't have to go back to the territorials, but I'm still on reserve. We all the start of the did they start the P reserve, which became Z reserve, or the start of the Z reserve, which became P reserve? I can't remember, but at any rate, we're all still on it. I've never had any, and my friends up in the Legion, they've never had any documentation to tell them that they're no longer on it. So I might have been called up for Iraq, you never know. If they'd given me a crutch.
What was it like getting employment again after the war?
Ah, well, of course, there was rules and regulations about that. Your employers had to take you back, even if they managed to whittle you out later. But I mean, I still had my apprenticeship to finish at Doxford's. You see, so when Doxford's took me back, and they were very good because the what was it? The government of your apprenticeship, the government paid so much enhancement on your apprentice pay, but doctors made it up to my normal pay as if I'd been out of my time. I got fitter's pay, you know, while I was serving apprenticeship, which was very good, really. But I had no trouble that way. But
well, what do you think, looking back at the period of incarceration by the Japanese, and how do you think it affected you?
I got a lot out of it. Having said that, having come through fairly well, I don't say that I never regret going through it. I mean, you couldn't say that. But I learned an awful lot. I mean, I was only a youngster going in. As I said, I was 21, 13 days after the taken prisoner. And, you know, you were still comparatively young in our day, when you're in your 20s, early 20s, or teens, anyway. I mean, now, like old men when they're 15, but not then. So that I had a lot to learn about life, and I learned a lot. I came out a much more tolerant bloke than I went in, I know. Capable of seeing another bloke's side of the story. And appreciated things which I'd never appreciated before, just taken for granted. Once or twice I've done talks to people, and I knew they'd ask me something like that, so I've always taken along a clean pocket handkerchief in my top pocket, and I've said, you know, about learning to appreciate things, and I pull out the handkerchief, and you know, at home, I said, you use one of these, you put it in the laundry, and you get a clean one out. You use it, and you put it in the laundry, you get a clean one out. You go on, you think nothing about it as long as there's some in the drawer. Now, when you've gone 3.5 years, as I did, with a torn off corner of a piece of brocade curtain as a handkerchief, and that's all you had, and you used it, and you washed it in the river, and you dried it in the sun, and you used it. And that was the only handkerchief I had in 3.5 years, and some didn't even have that. So you appreciate what a bit of linen like this is worth. So it taught you an awful lot of values that you'd never had before. You'd just taken things for granted. Waste, I can't stand. I cannot stand waste. You know, we went so short of stuff. That's what annoys me now. I don't like to eat out much because they always give you massive great portions because everybody says, oh, go there, you know, you get well fed. And far more very often than I can eat, and often not what others can eat. And it all goes back as waste. I once said that to a proprietor of a hotel. I stayed in for 2 or 3 nights. He came and sat down at the table. I was having breakfast the morning I was leaving to ask if I'd enjoyed it. I said, yes. The place actually where we'd been during the war. And I went back for old time's sake to have a look. And he said, are there any complaints at all, Mr. Wiggum? I said, only one. What's that? I said, man, you give us far too much. You know, if only you'd give us a little less and say, if you want any more, shout out. And then either you send stuff back, which is not very encouraging for the chef, or else you stuff yourself until you're uncomfortable so the meal's really spoiled. He said, I know, he said, we all make that mistake, really, we ought to watch it. I said, you should. And then in a way, I suppose it's a backhanded sort of complaint, a compliment in a way, the way you feed people. But I said, you know, I said, I can't stand the waste. I hate to think that this stuff's going to waste. And they all do it. I went to an hotel after that. I was running around a bit, and a hotel in Gifford on the borders, And there was the only hotel I've been in, I think, where you got moderate proportions. Ample, but moderate, you know? Very good. But that, I think, is really the... sums my POW days up. I wouldn't want to repeat them, but I did, as a young fella, learn an awful lot, which I've tried to pass on.
What about the Japanese, then? What are your thoughts about them?
Not terribly good to publicise, really. I only met about two, I think, who I would call decent blokes. One was the Ladicado that I mentioned. And otherwise, even now, although, let's get this straight, I'm not blaming the modern Japanese for what happened to us. I mean, half of them, well, all of them weren't born, even. So, you know, it's daft to blame them. But their culture, we can see, I mean, who are with them? We can see the coming through showing that their culture hasn't changed a great deal. And I would still never trust them. We learned that their sense of honour and our sense of honour were totally different. And most of the lads I know would never trust them again. They couldn't. Mind the occasions I've met when I used to spend a lot of time up at the Wildfowl Park as a volunteer. We got all sorts around. We got the Japs and the Koreans with boots as well with us. Guards. We got them around, but I treated everybody precisely the same, whether they were ethnic or us or anything. I'm not racist at all. And I tried to offer them the same courtesy as offered everybody else. But I wouldn't want to associate with them. That the sins of the fathers being visited on the youngsters, I suppose, but when you've collected the sins of the fathers, you can't very easily get rid of it.
It must have been difficult going through what you went through. It must have soured your opinion of the Japanese.
Oh, it did, absolutely. I mean, all of us, you know. There were one or two who come out and said, well, we must let bygones be bygones. Well, I mean, there's a book written, The Railway Man. I don't know if you've read it. How that lad could be as forgiving as he was. I had my own for it, don't get me wrong, but I couldn't have been. But not what he went through. But no, it's a funny position in a way, really. But you know, I just wouldn't want any close association with them at all. I know they appear, aren't they, charming little people, but they are on the surface. The Oriental veneer, but it's a very thin veneer. You can easily scratch through it. That's the trouble. You know? And I've seen them change. It's like switching a light on or off. From being quite pleasant and all the rest of it, and something's suddenly gone wrong. And, a complete change of character. Just like a switch. Oh, I'm queer. I suppose they have improved to some extent. They're not so very warlike now. I mean, they're very pacifist, a lot of them, you know. The atomic bomb taught them that, I think, which was a severe way to do it, but other people condemned the use of the atomic bomb, but it saved millions or thousands and thousands of lives anyway. Because if Japan had to be invaded, then what on earth a death toll would have been? I shudder to think. But, really, you know, I'm not belittling at all Nagasaki and Hiroshima, but the death toll in those cities wasn't as heavy as the death toll, I believe, in Tokyo itself from conventional bombing. And Hamburg, London, Coventry, you know. But I don't know, people's attitude's funny. It's not so bad if it's an ordinary bomb that kills you, but if it's an atomic bomb, it's terrible. You know? And I must admit that the world would have been a happier place if the atomic bomb had never been invented, I think. But, you